What do you think it means to be a person?
I don't know.
Me either. Really.
Go.
Say scratch that again.
Scratch that a fan.
I'm Caitlin Metz, a non-binary illustrator and designer.
I'm Rebecca Tossig, a disabled storyteller and writer.
And this is Scratch That, Parenting and Reparenting Off Script.
A podcast for people trying to parent and person at the same time.
Head over to our Patreon, Scratch That Podcast, for show notes and a transcript of today's episode. And also to join the conversation.
Thank you for being here. Hi, friends.
Happy Monday. I am just got a very butterfly in my stomach. We are interviewing Elsie Larson. This is a funny story. My origin story of knowing Elsie is that 5 million years ago, someone gave me their used laptop and they still had all their saved bookmarks on it. And Red Velvet, the store, I don't even know if you guys were going by A Beautiful Mess at the time, was linked on there. And I started, it was my introduction to following blogs hardcore. So this was I don't even know how to calculate years, but it was a long time ago.
More than 10, right?
Way more than 10. Yeah. It was before I even met my partner, and we've been married 10 years. So I found you and Emma, and you used to have this little shop in Springfield called Red Velvet.
Emma is Elsie's sister, by the way. Sorry to interrupt. Yes. Mm-hmm. For listeners, it's their duo.
I feel like everyone is going to know you, but that's only because I have known you on the internet for so long. But the thing that I have loved so much is watching you and Emma pivot. I've just watched you evolve in real time with so much joy and this trickster energy where you just adapt and you change. And I see you trying different things, and then watching you become a parent. You were one of the people before I decided to have a kid. I made a list of people I knew in real life and then just on the internet. And you were one of the people who I was okay, Elsie's doing creative shit. She's working for herself. I didn't grow up with much representation of what it is to work, to be creative, to have an identity outside of mothering. Mm-hmm. and also come to mothering with a bunch of joy. Mm-hmm. And so that is my particular current favorite evolution of you. But I'm just so excited because I have followed you forever and I feel like I know you, which is the joy and the curse of the internet.
Thank you. That was an amazing intro. I'm blushing. That was incredible. I do feel a kindred spirit with kind of anyone who you, when you have children in a similar decade, then you're going through so many of the same experiences and it is such a big part of life.
So to start off, Elsie, we often start our interviews asking folks about little you, little Elsie, because Caitlin has this idea that we are always at once every part of ourselves that we've ever been.
I love that. Wow.
So we want to know a little bit about the little Elsie. What can you help us understand about who you were as a little person?
Yeah. So my little person is alive and well. I think she's still in there. So are you interested in the Enneagram?
Oh, yes. Yes.
So my Enneagram is the 7. And I feel like I was the most 7 child. And my sister's a 9. And she was the most 9 child.
Oh, my gosh. I can totally see it for you, too. Yes.
So in that way, we've never changed. But, obviously, we've evolved. But we lived a very creative childhood. Our mother was an art teacher, but she didn't go to work until I was in junior high. So she just like took out all that energy on us. And that was kind of our main to do as I was growing up, was like, if we said we were bored, she was like, get out your paper, get out your pens. Why don't you write a story? Why don't you, you know? And it was a wonderful way to be raised. I think at the time I thought it was boring, but now I look back on it and I see that, like, if you fill every gap of space and time with activities, then you never get to develop that side of yourself. And so I do feel like a side of me that I still use, like I was using it last night, was developed in those like third, fourth, fifth grade years of being bored.
Well, and like part of what I really admire about observing you from a distance is like all of the different mediums that you seem like willing in. And maybe that's your seven part. Maybe it's just having a lot of time and space to explore all of it. But like Caitlin was saying, like clothes design, like you did clothes designing, you make recipes, you like are working on a novel. Like there's just all these different forms and mediums that you feel comfortable in. Like, do you feel like that's part, like the space you had to explore it all? Is it that spirit, that seven, like I must explore all the territory? Like where does that boldness and willingness to take risks and try something new come from?
Thank you. I feel like a big part of it is being a seven, because it's the desire to like try everything that comes through. So like if I do kind of suffer from FOMO, it's one of the ways that I can tell what I'm interested in life is just like watching other people and seeing if I get like a little jealous. And then if I do, that's how I started my blog. That's definitely, and yeah, the fashion. Currently I'm writing a novel. We're already started on my second one. So it's like always something. And in some ways, I think that's why we called our blog A Beautiful Mess. It was like a self-deprecating joke that I think I still stand behind. But anyway, I can't even remember what question I'm answering. Sorry.
Oh, no. It's okay. I mean, I just have so much admiration for it.
Thank you.
The willingness to like dive into something new, like writing a novel. I think what we've talked about on our podcast already a lot is like a very strong, I don't know, gene tendency towards perfectionism in my little family, like me, my partner, and my kid. And like, I think that, one of the things I feel like the most resentful about that tendency is the barrier to trying something new is so high. And I'm witnessing the way that you like that trickster energy, like that way, that willingness to pivot, that I think Big Magic is one of your favorite books, right, Elsie?
Yes.
We're referencing the trickster energy from Elizabeth Gilbert, Big Magic, beautiful book. But anyways, I just admire that. I look at that, and I also like the way that you describe using like jealousy as a tool for propelling yourself into, as opposed to like the thing that I imagine the most for jealousy, which is just stewing and building in resentment. You're like, oh, I noticed this feeling in me. Why don't I just do it? I love that.
Yeah. I think it's a good like manifesting tool to notice what makes you jealous, because like there is enough for everyone, and just like realizing that is the first step towards being able to like start yourself on your own journey to get what you really want.
I love that so much. Can we go back to talking about a boring childhood?
Yes.
Because this is something that I am deeply wanting to cultivate, and I think is like pretty countercultural.
There is like this demand, or it feels like this like pressure for all of the lessons and all of the sports and all of like the days. And I already feel like without that, I feel like our days feel so crunched and squished. And like, I pick you up from school, now we're like rushing to dinner, and now we're rushing to your bath. Like, where is the space to be bored? Sorry, I just wanted to underscore that.
Yeah. And I think I am noticing this like anxiety to be like, oh, I'm not getting Charlie in enough stuff. And also just being like, I do not want to be beholden to someone else's schedule. Like, we just signed him up for T-ball and it's on Friday nights for like 3 months in the spring. And I'm like low key already resenting it because I'm like, do you mean to tell me that like I have to be somewhere on Friday night at the same time? So part of this like is that I just like, I'm really disinterested in having a packed schedule in that way. But what I really want is to cultivate spaces for Charlie to get bored. And I think that it is increasingly hard for any age person to be bored because there's just like so much noise. And I, okay. Will you just say more about that, about a bored childhood? I want to hear how your childhood was boring in like the beautiful ways and how you're trying to cultivate that for your girls.
Yeah. I agree with you. I think that it is against our culture and you do have to sort of like have resilience against a certain amount of pressure to sign your kids up for every single thing. And also just like to not compare your family to other families that have activities every night of the week. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. I think a lot of people who do the activities every night of the week, like that's how they were raised and that's what they enjoy. It's definitely not how I was raised and not what I enjoy. So we do activities with our kids, but we keep it kind of light. And the reason for that, and especially in the summer, the reason for that is that Emma and I feel really strongly that the main thing that made us how we are, and we've like been pretty successful in our creativity. So we feel like the main thing that sort of like started that development was that our mom was just like very uninterested in signing us up for anything. And instead we had these, so like the things we had unlimited at, in our childhood were watching these like probably 8 to 12 VHS movies. And we have them all memorized.
Yes.
So that gets old. And then, you know, we had a certain number of books in the home. We went to the library, but that is limited, you know, and then the rest of it was just filling in space. So I remember like when I was in like fourth grade, I tried to design my own theme park, like on paper. And I had never like been to Disney World. I had heard of it. Just the idea of it was like, oh, this is something I need to try to invent another version of. And then I made this like family, sorry, I made like a, it was, I think it was supposed to be a book. I'm not sure what it was supposed to be, but what it ended up being was a map. And there was 26 families. And it was like family A, family B. And then it was like every person in the family has A names. And there, and then every person in the B family has B names. And then there's a picture of all of them for every single family. And then there's like a map of where their houses are and who's neighbors. And so it was like, I think I kind of fell off after that. But it was things like that my whole childhood that I think made me kind of the person I am, where by the time I was in my 20s, I didn't really go to college. I realized that I wanted money and I hadn't done anything to get a career. So I started like trying crazy stuff and some of it worked.
I didn't know about the college piece of it, but I like it's interesting that feels very on brand for our podcast and thinking about off script and kind of being able to pivot and imagine a different route. Mm-hmm.
I tell my kids, when you're an adult, you can have three careers, because I think that that is such a true, it's true. First of all, like most people don't have just one career anymore. Mm-mm. That's very rare. Mm-hmm. Like we don't live in the 50s, you know, like it's like how many people have you met, even who are 30 or 40, who have only done one career so far?
Mm.
So I think thinking of it as like, if it's 40 years, you know, if, and for most people, it's 40 to 50 years of your life that you are working for money. There's a lot of things you can do in that time, mm-hmm. more than just like choosing one thing.
And I like, I'm thinking of Nova is your older of your two, right, Nova? And at the end of your podcast, there's always like this little prompt from Nova at the end. And it's like a recipe or it's like a meditation. And I feel like, I don't know, I see the way that you're already like bringing that out in her, that like, she doesn't have to have one thing. She's not just the recipe kid or the meditations, but she has like all of these different little practices that she's already bringing in and feels like she can confidently share with this audience of podcasters, which is also maybe that like risk-taking sort of confidence in your own ability to step into something and speak to it with confidence.
Yeah. Thank you. It's been so much fun to let her have her little segment on the podcast. And at first, we thought we would just do it a couple times, but she loved it so much. She's been doing it now for, I think, like a year or two. And it's like, it's my favorite part. It's a lot of people's favorite.
I love it. I love it every time. It's so great.
It's so sweet. Listening to her, I already listened to the one today. It's my like Monday morning ritual, and her talking about the Girl Scout cookies. I was like, oh my God, I'm dead.
Oh yeah.
So sweet.
It's cookie season.
So sweet. The thinking about this space for boredom, I think as an adult is, I think when we grow up and we become parents and we're grownups and we're adults moving around the world and paying taxes, mm-hmm. we like forget to play. We forget who we are. Mm. And then we can, one thing that I very much do not want as Charlie gets older is for him to only have context of me as his parent, or as like one kind of like, I want him to know me in so many different spaces, because right now I feel like something I think about a lot is that I'm building the foundation for our future relationship. Like I'm only going to parent him in this way for a really small part of his life. And I want to lay the foundation for what as our relationship when he's like 16, 20, 40, 50 years old. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways that I think that I do that is by letting him see me as many things so that he'll have something to relate to as he gets older. I think when we stop playing and we don't give ourselves to be bored as adults, we forget that we can be so many things. And I, from what I see of you on the internet, is that you are a parent and like your love of being a parent is so evident.
Like the Halloween decorations.
Yeah, your joy for parenting and the way that you talk about the season of your life is so inspiring to me, because while that is like at the forefront of you and I see you making really specific choices in your career, in your podcast, in the blogging, so that you can be present in the season with your kids, you are also so many other things at the same time. And I just wonder if you can like say words to that. I don't have a specific question.
Can I tag on to that? Sorry. I just like, I think that it's interesting. It is just really interesting for us to hear about this seven energy that you cultivated as a child and this willingness to try so many different things. Right. But I'm just so curious what happens when children intersect into that energy. Like, was it difficult for you to continue that kind of creative range? And like, was there a learning curve with adjusting to that? Or did it feel like it fit really naturally into the creative energy that being a parent had? Like, I kind of am watching this in wonder and would love to hear like the behind the scenes, what that felt like or what went into that, continuing to cultivate that within yourself.
Yeah. I love this question. I do feel like I had to fight for it. And it was a transition, like what Caitlin was saying, every different phase with your children is so short. And like, you know what I mean? And you're like just getting the groove of it. And then it changes to something different.
Yeah.
The following year. But I would say that like I became a parent when I was 35. I think I was 34 or 35. I was like ready. I was more than ready. I became a parent through adoption. We had like a several year process. We had years where we were trying before that to become a family. So we like So I was like very ready. And I didn't have a hard transition at first, but then I had a rough patch after we adopted our second child. It was also the pandemic era during that time, which I think for any parent is like, don't talk about it. I don't want to think about it. I don't want to remember. You know what I mean? It's like, just, you know, it was what it was. But so I had a moment when I think I was like close. I was also like getting closer to turning 40. And it was just like everything hit me at once. I felt like really lonely. I felt like I didn't have the friendships I wanted, partly because of the circumstances and then partly because of just like the choices I was making. And so I did have to fight at that moment to sort of like regain like what's my thing? Like what's my goals? Like what is my creative life and what do I want to build for myself? Because once I realized it was a problem, I was like, well, I'm going to build what I want for being 40, but I'm also going to build towards what I want at 50 so that I don't have to do this all again. Because it was like a 2-year thing. It was pretty painful. I think that like it's okay to have those moments where you wake up and realize like, oh, I kind of lost my own sense of identity. Mm-hmm. And I also had that problem with social media where I was like so excited to like share little things about my kids for a while that I got where I was like only sharing about my kids. And then I was like, oh, this is like not what I meant to do. And then I had to switch that. So I think it's always a process of like evolving. But if you're making sure that you're making choices for yourself 10 years from now, then I think you're in a good place.
Oh, that's so smart. I'm almost 40. And I feel like that idea of anticipating 50 was not even on my radar, like to plan that far ahead. Would you mind naming any of the things that you actually did to start thinking towards that? Like, what does that hands-on practice look like?
Yeah. So for me, I had a little bit of a flip out at the point where I realized that I believed for a while that I had already achieved all the goals I had set for myself. And then I lost it, like a full meltdown. And I was just like, that doesn't feel good. Like, I want to have bigger goals. I want to have things to reach for, things to strive for. And like, you can be so happy with your life, but I think that a thing that I love is a goal. So I had to create new dreams and a new plan, like a new vision for what I wanted. And it ended up being super fun and something that I would think anyone should do it if you're interested. It was like the most fun I ever had. And now I'm writing my novels and I'm working on an art career. And I feel like now, if I retired tomorrow, I would have a full schedule and I would know exactly what I wanted to do with my time. And that feels really like secure. So yeah, I think it's just like revisualizing everything.
And side note, if you're interested in what Elsie is saying about goal setting, and as someone who often gets really anxious around the idea of goal setting, the episode that you and Emma did on, I don't remember what the title was. It was around the new year on like goals for 2025 or something, was it was such a non-threatening conversation about goal setting. It felt really like all on the side of exciting and really open-handed and not full of like the dread or the shame that's to come when we don't meet those goals, but like really, really nourishing the positive and exciting part of goal setting. So I just want to, we'll put a link into that episode in our show notes so people can have a little taste of that because it was a great conversation.
You.
And you and Emma, we keep referencing Emma so much. I'm like, oh, we should have had her on here too.
Hi, Emma.
Yeah.
You guys talk so beautifully about aging in a way that's just so exciting to me because their representation. I do see it getting better. And maybe I'm like particularly, I really seek out following people who are like 10, 20, 30 years ahead of me who are like vibrant, excited to be alive, because there is still this like narrative that after 30, like, what the fuck's the point of you? And seeing the way that you guys are so excited to get old and like the things that you want to do is that feels like it ties into this like building a bridge to the future with your kid and with yourself, that there's not like an end, and making space to, like, I feel like our 20s, there's so much space made for us to like not know and figure it out and dream.
Explore.
And to be doing that in our 30s. I turned 36 this year and I had a complete freak out because I was like, I am now closer to 40 than 30.
Yeah, it's almost like it's not going to stop.
It's not going to stop. And my panic about aging is like not about dying or like not looking cute or something, but it's just like, have I done all the things? There's so many things I want to do, and it feels like there was a limit or like I should have done them by now. And so I feel like I am like smack in the middle of this, like, okay, what the fuck do I actually want? And that's tied up with like a bunch of other things. Interrupting this episode to say thank you to everyone supporting the podcast on Patreon.
We love seeing your comments come through. We love getting to know each of you better. Like, you being there really means the world to us.
If you want to support the project financially, you can become a paying patron for as low as $5 a month. That's less than a latte.
But there's lots of free ways to support the podcast too. Sharing episodes, giving us one of those very pretty 5-star reviews, all of that makes a huge difference too.
And you can also join Patreon without paying. So the show notes will always be there for you. Okay, back to the show.
Can I ask about adoption? We talk so much on this podcast about like the scripts around us. A lot of times these scripts or narratives that we have that we're not aware of. And I think adoption is one that you would be able to speak to. What are the scripts that people often hold about adoption and what that means, and like the things that you hear people say over and over and over again that they don't realize they're the 100th person to say that to you? Like, could you speak a little bit about what you've observed about the really default common scripts that we have about adoption? And maybe part two of that question is, how would you like to revise that script?
Yeah, I think that being an adoptive parent, you have to be an advocate for adoption, regardless of if you want to or not. Like, it just like comes with the job, you know? So there are lots of times I have different ways that I approach it, but I would say, like, as far as the cliches, the biggest one that we experience because of our children being adopted from China is that white people and American people just like repeat the narrative, Chinese people don't want daughters, which is not true. It hasn't been true for a long time. It's like old information, maybe from when I was a little kid or something. But then it like puts you in the awkward position where you have to be like, well, and even one day one of my kids said it. And I was like, where did you hear that from? Like, they're getting it. Like, these people are getting their influence. And like, it's just such a common cliche, though, that it's like you almost, it feels like screaming into the wind to try to like educate people one person at a time about like the one child policy and how it hasn't been a policy for a long time.
So you there's a weariness that comes with like, all right.
There is. Yeah. And then we have other things, like our children have albinism. So we have a whole, there is like, it's a thing, like people coming up in public, asking intrusive questions about their appearance. And also a lot of people ask with the children present if they're quote unquote real sisters, probably every week that happens. And like, so in a way, I'm glad that like they, like one time a person with albinism told me, you know, my mom, like I grew up hearing my mom respond to it, and that's how I learned to respond. And like knowing that gave me this good like inspiration that like I should always respond like, because I kind of sometimes want to respond like a smartass, but I try to always do it with love to teach the kids, because it's like their whole life they're going to have to do this whether they like it or not.
Yeah.
So
wow.
Yeah, it does get old. And I learned a lot from it, like things that I would never go up to someone and say. Like I would never go up to someone and make a comment about their appearance or like something like that. Cause now I know that they hear that like 100 times a year.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's so interesting to hear you. Cause first we're talking about the weariness of having to answer that question or respond to that misconception over and over and over again. But that shift from like, maybe the interaction isn't as much about teaching that individual as it is about teaching your daughter something.
It has to be from my perspective, just to like make it feel like it matters.
It reminds me a little bit of as like a wheelchair user parent and being in public and the difference. There is this difference that I have felt like in my body of growing up, like my whole life answering kids' questions about wheelchairs, right? Like, of course, everywhere I go. But how different those conversations feel now that my son is watching them, and how it really does feel like the way that I respond to me is so much more about showing him something and teaching him something than it is necessarily about teaching the kid asking the question. It's quite a shift. And for me, it does make that practice feel a lot more meaningful, because there is a weariness of like, really, the 600th person that's going to ask this. But are there any other things that are scripts that you would notice or that you want to speak to? And no pressure if that's not where you want to go.
Yeah, the last one that comes to mind is the idea, like, usually like older people ask me like, were you not able to have kids of your own? And which is like, is so offensive and like it, but at the same time, it is a question that, I have to answer regularly. And I think it is like, that is how societal norms like, and things change, is like someone taking the time to explain, like, I adopted by choice. I wanted to adopt. I always wanted to adopt. Like, that's, it's okay. So yeah, but yeah, it's awkward.
Isn't it interesting when it's like somebody comes to you as if, like, without any awareness that, like, this is not an original question, like, that people approach it like, I have this,
people like chase us through the airport to ask us these questions. And it's like, it's so funny, like, to think like,
so invasive.
Yeah.
Well, so we talked about the scripts that are fucked up. What are the scripts that we want? Like, as if we could in this like 40 minutes rewrite how we view adoption. Maybe it is also, what are the scripts you're wanting to give your kids about this? Because as we talk about, you guys you're having this like one singular interaction with a stranger. So that's only like one blip in their life. But your kid is hearing this multiple times a day for their entire life. And so like, what are the scripts that you're wanting to give them? And then what are the like the wider ones that you wish societally we could embrace?
Yeah, well, I think that like sometimes my children will answer the questions for us, which is fun because they're at the age now where they can. And if someone asks like, "Are you real sisters?" they will say no. Like they will answer, "We're from different provinces." And I think it's like a thing that I felt like I had to tiptoe around, you know, in a way. And now it's like, oh, they like fully understand both sides of it, and they. So, yeah, it feels really good. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I as far as like what I wish that people were just like more curious to hear stories about adoption, because there are many. Mm-hmm. They are varied. And I my experience, like when we first kind of got into it, was that people always wanted to like tell me the story of like their cousin or their someone they met or someone they knew, which is like, it's cool, but it's like, it's not really like information. It's just like these experiences, there's as many of them as stars in the sky. Yeah. Like, you know what I mean? So I think if people kind of knew that, that like adoption isn't just like one experience, mm-hmm. Or even two, I think some people think it's like, you know, the domestic or the international, but it's like there's way more variation than that. And even within people who did our exact same program, which is, you know, a very specific program, even their experiences were wildly different from mine.
Curiosity and understanding the vast range of ways that people move through these kinds of narratives.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that's interesting because that's how I feel about disability so much, too. It's like, it's so funny the patterns that we can see in this overlap, because it's the same with disability that someone's like, my cousin also used a wheelchair. And it's like, wow. All right. Yeah. Like, means so much to me. Yeah, it's funny how the something about like the grooves around or the patterns we have around recognizing difference and trying to connect, but in this way that is actually like a disconnect. I think it's an attempt to connect, or it's just something like that. An attempt to relate without curiosity or something.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. So yeah, I think if I'm meeting someone who's adopted, I'm going to just like ask them a couple questions about their experience and try to learn something. I think that's a good way to approach it.
Yeah, for sure. I'm also curious. And again, I didn't expect there to be so many overlaps in these questions that I'm asking in my own family and with yours. But, one thing that I have become really interested in is, when a parent and a child embody different identities, and kind of how to navigate that gap. So like for me and my son, as of right now, like his mom holds this identity of being a physically, visibly disabled woman, and he doesn't share several of those identities. And so like moving through the world together and how to hold those things is interesting. And I think as a parent, so you have these two daughters that embody different identities than you. They're from different country than you, and they have albinism. How do you think about and navigate the different identities that you hold, or like how do you approach or think about that? And I'm also curious if that has changed as they've gotten older.
I think that that's an interesting question. Like sometimes I feel like people feel like they need to reassure me. Like a comment that I often get is like, even though your daughter's adopted, she looks just like you. And I'm like, no, she doesn't. Like it's like
interesting.
It's confusing.
Yeah.
So I feel like I am like completely at peace with like, we are a Chinese American family. You know, we're not just an American family anymore. Mm-hmm. And yeah, my children have disabilities and they have things that like I like cannot experience, and like I always wish that there was like a way I could like live a day with their vision so that I, you know, could like understand it more fully. But I think that I just don't try to lie about it. So I think that like that's kind of it for us right now, is just like leaving space for like, and it's not a big deal, I guess. Like it's like we have, this is our family.
Yeah. What I like about that is not to minimize how unique that is for your specific family or mine, but also it's interesting that the assumption would be that if your children didn't have those distinct, like almost like checkbox identity differences, that they would, that you would experience the world the same way in some ways. So I'm just thinking about like,
right.
Of course, like it's just interesting, like that there is that the default assumption would be that you would be the same as your kids, when actually like, isn't that part of the fundamental part of creating a different person? I don't want to minimize. There's a both and to this, because I think that there are ways that like it is distinctly different to move through the world with low vision and 20/20 vision. It's distinctly different to move through the world in a wheelchair or not in a wheelchair. So that is one thing. And also, I don't like Micah, my husband, walks and auto walks. And I don't think that that automatically makes them understand each other perfectly or makes them, you know, like there's this way that there are these massive gaps between us and our kids that cannot be erased no matter what because they're separate people.
Yeah. You said it perfectly. Like I could, yeah, better than I could. I think that that's true. It's like maybe it draws more like attention to the fact that you're different people, but you're still going to be different people even if you look exactly like your mom and dad.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Well, it feels like we hold this like misconception. Like there is, well, we talk a lot about like the grief of knowing that our kids are going to have different stories than us and knowing that we can't control it. And there is like this deep ache there because we want to like write the most beautiful story for our kids and we want to be able to control it. And also like that is not within our capacity. But I think when you do look like you have the same things, you can kind of like run under the radar. You can just kind of like hold on to that little belief. And then one day it's all going to be shattered. And so I think the beauty of both of you having such distinctly different identities from your children is that like you can't just, I mean, you could in other ways, but hopefully that gives pause. And I think about that a lot with Charlie. I mean, Charlie and I have different bodies and ways that we're going to move through the world. And but it is so easy for me to assume that he's going to be just like me or that I could control that. And so my work is just like constantly pulling that apart and being like, you are your own person and you exist and you see the world in ways that I can never, even though on some level we are holding more similar identities. Mm-hmm. But I feel like this is the work of being a parent. And this like releasing or just being a human, like going back to the questions that people are asking about adoption and just how like just like leaving space for curiosity, letting difference exist, not feeling like you need to know all of the answers. Like the absurdity of the questions that people are asking is like that they're just trying to like put you into like the one little file cabinet in their brain where they understand this difference.
Yeah.
When they could just like let it be open. Like you don't need to categorize me or like put me in a box immediately.
Yeah. Like this like big thing that you notice when you first see my family is something that I barely even think about. So it's like it's not like something that I wake up thinking about every day. It's like because we're used to it and that's how everyone feels, you know, in like the body and the family that they have.
Yeah. It's just something that people can feel like they can see and quickly assume something from the outside in. But it's interesting. I mean, I think that if we could channel that from the beginning of like, we're different people and we experience the world mm-hmm. differently. If we could all channel that from the beginning, I feel like that would be such a gift to all the parties and within a family. And I think part of what feels good about that approach is that it invites curiosity about each other. Like mm-hmm. we're like take assumptions off the table and kind of be curious about what it's like to be the other person. And I'm curious as you're, this is going to come out clunky, but like as your girls are growing up, I'm curious if you are finding ways that you feel like you are understanding their experiences of the world more, either through them being able to articulate it or through connecting with people who maybe, I don't know. It's not like if you were to read a memoir about a girl that was adopted from China who also has albinism and low vision, that would mean that you understand your daughter. But there is, I don't know if there's a way that would help you begin to sort of ask new questions. I'm not sure. So my question is, are you finding ways that you feel like you are learning through them or through other narratives about what the world might feel like from their POV?
Definitely. Yeah. Anytime I get to meet an adult with albinism, mm-hmm. it's like such an illuminating experience for me and so helpful. Mm. And I always get, you know, some kind of great advice. So, yeah, I think that there are certain things also that you do have to learn as you go. Like when my daughter got like the grade that I first got bullied in was third grade. So when my daughter entered third grade this year, I realized I was expecting it to happen. Mm. And it's like, there's no reason, like it might or it might not. So I think that, yeah, it's the biggest learning experience mm-hmm. to parent kids. And you have to just like constantly remind yourself things, reevaluate, keep learning, stay open. Yeah.
Well, and that reminds me of what you said about that adult that you met who said that they were learning about, I don't want to put words in your mouth. It was like they learned about albinism through the way that their mother talked about it. So that's like part of that, right? Is like you took that in and it seems like that shaped the way that you approach those questions.
It did. Because like previous to that, I was like getting so burned out with people's questions that I was starting to be a smartass sometimes. And then after that, I never did it again.
Wow.
It was powerful. Yeah. And it was important for me to hear that.
Man, that smartass moment, though, was so cathartic.
I mean, I do it in my head now.
Yeah. Yeah.
I feel like as we've been talking, I'm imagining like five other conversations I want to have. We haven't even talked about our shared evangelical upbringing.
I love it. Okay, Rebecca, I didn't know. Do you have a can of trauma to open to?
Oh, Elsie.
Yes, yes.
Okay, Elsie, I didn't know this about you until Caitlin told me, but you also got married really young and divorced really young, as did I. So like grew up in a very, like this is how you need to live in the world. And this is, the right and the wrong and the heaven and the hell and the path. And, I married my high school boyfriend at 22 and was divorced within a year, which was a huge part of, I don't know that we need all this context actually in the podcast, but for context for you, that was a huge part of sort of this great, pulling apart and script writing and revision of like, mm-hmm. I thought that the world was only this way and that I could only be this way. And there was just this explosion of curiosity and exploration as a newly divorced 22-year-old. And there was a lot of clarifying, right? Like as a lot of people kind of disappeared from my world and didn't want to do any of that exploration or witness any of that exploration, and other people who remained open and did want to stay connected to me through that. And I was just really curious. Again, we don't have to include this in the recording unless everyone feels comfy, but when I heard that about you, I was like, I don't know very many people who lived that experience. And I'm just curious how that, my question for you would be, how did that experience play a role in who you are right now? If the original question was like, tell us about little Elsie, I'm curious about how that Elsie still lives in you and what that Elsie learned and how that turned into Elsie that's across the screen from us right now.
That's such a good question. It is definitely a defining experience of my life. But I don't think I'm like carrying it with me all the time anymore. At least I'm trying not to, because it's so heavy. And whenever I get into it, I've been in my, I guess, like, I don't really call it deconstruction, but like people call it deconstruction. I've been in that phase for like 18 years, and it isn't that much lighter for me than it was when I started, which is confusing. I've done like 5 years of therapy for it. Like I feel like I've done everything I could do. And at this point, I think it's like just part of why I'm on this earth is that I had that experience so that I can understand it, I guess, because like there's no justice in it. and it still makes me upset to like, to relive it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would also say that, okay, mine was it 18 years ago? It sounds so long, but mine might be similar. And it's funny that it doesn't feel that long ago in a lot of ways. I mean, it's like both, right? Like in some ways it's like, I'm not even, that's not even the world I occupy in. And then something can be said or remind me of something. And it's like, no time has passed at all for me. And my feelings feel just as acute and loud as ever. But there is, I don't know, there is something, I think for me, that level of disruption in my way of seeing the world, for good or for bad, I think kind of holds me perpetually in this state of like ready for another disruption. Like, what do I believe so much right now that could change? Does that resonate, that Caitlin in Elsie? Okay.
Yeah.
Because that's a weird, I don't know if it's, I don't know how to evaluate what that does or doesn't do for me in the world. Like in some ways, I think that that's an asset. And in some ways, I feel like it's like a virus that still lives in me. I don't know how to feel about it. What do you guys think about that?
I think for me, it's why I try to always stay moderate in all things, always and forever. It's like a core belief that I hold now that being extreme is never better. And I get it. Like sometimes there are these things that are good and you think like more of that will always be better, but there does always come a point with the brainwashing. So I think that's, why I'm like it's so important to me to be moderate and to always try to see both sides of everything, yes, to just at least to just try.
Yeah.
You know, at least to try.
Yeah. Yeah. Caitlin?
I have just like a million thoughts. The thing that came to me as Elsie was just talking is that, so I came out of this, it was like my whole life, I came out of it and I was like, oh, I'm going to enter this, like, the world. Mm-hmm. I'm going to enter the world and it's going to be so welcoming and open, mm-hmm, because all I had known was like restriction and legalism and like judgment. And I was like, oh, I'm going to go over here and it's going to be wild and free. And that was not what I found. What I found was myself in some super liberal spaces that I was like, what the fuck? We're policing.
Policing is the
how
word.
How we talk.
Yeah.
The languaging, mm-hmm, we're using. We're canceling people. I'm like, this idea of canceling is not new. That was called excommunication.
Mm-hmm.
And I just like was like, you guys are doing the same fucking thing. You cannot see past your nose.
Yeah.
You've decided you're right. You've decided everyone else is wrong. And even though I agree, like I came to this space because I agree.
And also, the ways that humans are just very bad at coexisting in difference and remaining curious about each other. I think fear can be such a big driver, and like this thing that's beautiful in humans is like really caring about something and believing in it and being passionate about it, and also how that can tumble into not listening anymore and not taking in any new information and shutting people out and closing down conversation, and how that pattern just repeats itself in so many different ways. I think what that highlights is that, yes, there is something distinct about God being a part of that policing, and also there's just something very human in that need to control and the fear of difference.
Yeah.
That feels inescapable, or like something that requires a great deal of practice and intention, mm-hmm, to avoid.
Yeah, yeah. No, I love it. So now I'm like really attracted to spaces where people are leaving. I think this is part of why I got so interested in fiction, is like the morally gray spaces are like, everything to me. Like, I like being in there and thinking about it, you know, and having the freedom to do that without judgment or without pressure. So that, yeah, I can never be a part of a like high control group probably ever again. And I think that that's a very common experience for ex-evangelical people. I think that we're going to remain open-minded at all costs.
Well, and nothing is always true. There's like, they talk about absolute truth, and it's like, okay. One of the most painful critiques or things that was said to me as I left, as I was like kind of coming out about my like not believing the things that I had been taught to believe, was that I didn't believe anything. And that was like really, really painful for me, because in some of the things that was like the culmination of me leaving was a pastor like being willing to bypass the like baptism like counseling for me, because he was like, I know you, like you're a good girl. And I was at the time having like premarital sex. And so I was like, you don't fucking know me. Mm-hmm. And I was just very interested in integrity, in like my beliefs and my actions being in alignment, and not having like one belief or action that's right, but that those being in harmony was what was true. And so I was in this space of like feeling deeply tied to a belief, but it didn't have like a denomination or a like theory to it. It was just me being like, I want to know that if I take an action, that I stand behind it, that like I, because the like amount of hypocrisy and like performance of the rule versus the like living out the thing that you felt was true. That just came to me when Rebecca, you were like, what is the thing that I hold to? And that has been really painful for me, because I don't have a conventional, easily pointed to belief that I can be like, this is the thing. But I have like deeply held convictions. And I am perpetually, I feel like, on this journey of like better aligning my internal and external.
Martha Beck, The Way of Integrity.
Oh my God, that book.
Yeah.
Like really, really broke.
Yeah.
My concept of like morality, like wide open for me. Have you read that, Elsie?
No,
it's nonfiction. Nonfiction.
It's nonfiction. I'm low key obsessed with Martha Beck. She's also came out as, she was raised Mormon. She had like kids, like married, did the whole thing, and then came out as queer. And I believe she lives in a throuple now, and is also besties with Glennon Doyle and Elizabeth Gilbert.
Cool.
Which is like the white lady trifecta.
But, you know, Caitlin, what you're saying reminds me a little bit about what we talked about with Abby Van Meter, which is sort of like less than emphasis on what's the right script and more an implementation of tools, and like having a toolbox of tools, of curiosity, of compassion, and like the flexibility to use those tools in different ways, maybe, as opposed to being like, this is the structure we built, and if one nail falls out of that structure, the whole thing is gone.
And I think that's what we're trying to do here with like doing it off script. Like, we're doing this brand new. Like, my parents and their parents like used this like one rule book, and they like followed certain people's, and you know, Dr. Dobson.
I had like an actual reaction in my body when you said that. No, it's all right. It's all right.
It's like saying Voldemort. How are we raising our kids outside of the paradigm of them just being evil, destined for hell?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, like we fully reject the idea of hell. I think it's like, for me, it took me a long time to like come to it, but I think it's the number one thing that I reject from the evangelical culture. And unfortunately, it's kind of baseline for most churches. But it's crazy. It's crazy to think that you can tell children that they have to believe the same religion as you or they will go to hell and burn forever. Like, it's so manipulative. And if you like, and I understand there's like, it's hard to see that when you believe that it's true. And I don't believe it's true. But anyway, I'm raising my children with the idea that they get to pick what faith they have. And it really is that simple. And the main thing when someone in our life says something that we disagree with, we let them say it because it's part of like teaching our children to live in the world. We let them say it as long as they're not scaring our kids. Okay. But we're always reminding them that nobody knows for sure. And that's like sort of like our number one, like nobody knows for sure is like the thing we always come back to. And it is true. Mm-hmm. And it sort of like takes the power away from people who want to claim that they know for sure.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, it's interesting if we're talking about faith. I mean, isn't that built into the word? Like, a certain amount of not knowing or like uncertainty. And so, right. So like,
oh, no, to have faith is to know and to know.
It's gotten lost in translation somewhere. There's a piece of that we've lost because I think that's part of what it's supposed to be is like, there is a great mystery in this world and we're all trying to figure out how to understand it. And,
and we see through a glass now darkly. Is that not? And one day it will be revealed.
Oh, you're quoting Bible verses. Oh, no. I missed it. Shit.
I'm very curious about this conversation of death. Charlie's been really asking a lot about death. My response has been everything has a beginning and end. And when you die, you return to the earth. And so when things die, they return to the earth. And we talk about
I like that.
Life cycles. I don't know if I'm doing it right. Maybe one of Andrew and my proudest parenting moments thus far is Andrew and Charlie are playing a video game. And Andrew was, it was like a nonviolent video game. But Andrew like kicked, I don't know, he did something. I don't totally condone this. But anyways, he was like, oh, I sent that person to heaven. And because he was like trying to like say that he killed someone. He was talking to me. And Charlie goes, who's heaven? And Andrew and I just looked at each other and we were like, we have done well to have, like, he's four and he like thought heaven was a person.
Mm.
Which sometimes I don't know if I, you know, I think we had this, we talked about the paradigms we're building, Rebecca, and it's sometimes I worry that I'm sheltering him too much. You know, like he's lived a very, very insular life. And his like first foray into like spaces outside of our like little family and Andrew's parents has been this like very granola woo, like little nature school. And so it does, I feel like I need to tell him these things so that he hears it from me first. So I feel like I'm on the other end where I'm like, have I sheltered him too much from these ideas and held it too far away from him that one day he's going to like have this like huge shock that things are horrible?
No, don't stress about it. Don't stress about it. It's not a big deal.
He's four. He's got time, right?
We tried to prep our kids, but it took years really. Like, and there are still moments when a family member or like one time a kid on a school bus told our daughter that she was going to hell. And like, it's a little scary, but she has like some, she already has some information, you know, that's coming from people she trusts. So it's like the world isn't a threat. I think that like teaching your kids to live in it is, it's okay.
Well, and so much of what you talk about, Caitlin, is like developing that relationship with Charlie. And the thing that you focus on is that bond. And I think part of that is so that when he is maybe on the bus one day, and Alcee, I imagine you do the same thing with your kids, is like they will come and tell you. Like, that's part of the work that you're doing with Charlie now, is so that when that conversation does come up, that he knows that he's safe to share it with you. And you that's when you get to get in there and process it together. I think you're doing just that.
Can I ask a final question? It's a tiny one. Today, Caitlin and I posted an episode about making a mixtape with our listeners. And it's everyone is picking a song that has, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but like we're picking a song that has made us feel grounded, that has made us bring us back to our core values, that is like a grounding song in the world, a song that has held us as a parent or a person. Do you have a song we can add to the playlist?
Tell me your songs first.
Okay. Caitlin, you go first.
Mine is Through the Ages by Cloud Cult.
It's gorgeous. Okay. Mine is like a song that I found in adolescence. Dar Williams is like a folk singer that I don't know that most people, I don't know how many people know of her. But she was like this folksy folk singer that came into my kind of closed system world and spoke a different story about belonging and acceptance and people being different. And the song I picked was Mercy of the Fallen, which is a song that came on the radio as I drove away from this really hard conversation about my divorce. And it was sort of this song that's about like resting in the unknowing and like you thought you had a map of this world and actually there are like a million stars that we're following and that there is kind of rest in kind of being stumbling along, basically. So yeah, those are the songs we added.
That's beautiful. Okay, I'm just going to like look at my Spotify and pick one from my liked page because I can't. This is so fun when I'm like terrified.
When we pulled the outline for the music episode, I had like.
You did.
And Rebecca was like, Caitlin, we're only doing one song. And I was like, it's okay. I just needed all the songs to know that they could live here.
Okay, I have it. It's perfect.
Okay.
It's The Flaming Lips. All We Have Is Now.
Which one is that?
It's from the Yoshimi record.
Is that the... And we have this now.
Okay, I can't hear it in my head. I'm so excited to go listen.
Okay. We're going to add it to the playlist if that's okay with you.
Okay.
Yeah. Caitlin, I think we should start asking all of our guests for their song and then... Okay.
That's beautiful.
Elsie, your music challenge... I don't know if you still do it, but when... I think this was just when you had Nova... Isn't the internet so weird? I just like we know so many things about people from the internet. But you had this jar and every week they wrote down all these different artists. And every week Nova got to pick one and then they like prioritized playing that artist that week. Isn't that fucking brilliant?
I love that.
It's a really fun exercise. It's good for adults too. It's really good for anyone who like gets either you want to educate yourself on something or you get stuck, you know, like. In a certain, so yeah, I think it's, you can do it also like a million different times and you never run out of things to try. We've done also movies and that was fun.
I love it. I love it so much. I think that's something I want to do with Andrew.
That's a good idea.
That would be such a cute like couple activity. Yeah, I love that. Music, as an ex-evangelical, I feel like music has a particularly,
That's right.
Rich meaning in my life. And the thing I miss the most is the like in church, everyone sings in the kind of churches I grew up in. Everyone sings together. It doesn't matter if you sing well or not. And one of my moments, do I have time for me to tell a tiny story?
Tell a tiny story. And then we're going to say goodbye.
The tiny story is I went to a Coheed and Cambria concert around the time that I was deconstructing. And I had a migraine, as I often do. And so I ended up in the back. And it was in this, like, really grungy, like, divey bar venue. And everyone was, like, everyone's energy was towards the stage. Like, the hands were raised. The bodies were, like, the movement. And I was like, oh, we are the Holy Spirit. Like, when you're like, there's a sweet, sweet spirit in this place. And it's like... We're all orienting ourselves towards one thing and like we're all activating our vagus nerve because we are singing and that moment has like, I was like maybe 22 has just like lived in my body that like that feeling that you had in church when everyone is like lifting their voice in song is us. Like we are that thing and our bodies are like like the research on what your nervous system does when you co-regulate,
yeah,
and the like self-soothing of the singing and the like the humming and that like deep guttural vibration in your throat. And I'm always like, I am the Holy Spirit. Like, we are the Holy Spirit. Like, this, in the moments where I like want to kind of like cling to that in the past, but I love the idea of asking everyone this question at the end, because this is music, I think, unites us in ways that I don't know that there's another thing that can bring people together the way music does.
Caitlin, I was like getting teary-eyed listening to you describe that. I did feel like that feeling of being in a room with people all singing and like orienting spirits in one direction. Like, yeah, I feel that too. Okay. Thank you so much, friends. This was beautiful. I feel like we could talk to you forever. Elsie, we want to point people towards your podcast and also your blog, right?
Sure. Yeah. My podcast is called the A Beautiful Mess Podcast, and my blog is abeautifulmess.com.
A delight.
Thank you for the time.
Yes. Thank you so much, Elsie.
Thank you. Thank you both so much.
Bye, friends.
Bye.
Bye. Love you.
You tell me when we're done, okay?
This podcast is edited and perfected by the most beautiful wizard and my favorite dude, Micah Jones.
For all the show notes and a transcript of today's episode, check out our Patreon, Scratch That Podcast. This is our hub. It's where you can join the conversation and be part of our community.
If today's episode resonated with you or made you think of someone, share it.
And if you want to support the pod and also make us glow inside, go give a 5-star review on Apple. That would be so lovely.
Thank you for being here, for listening, for being a part of this community.
We love you so much.